to one of the pirogues. While some of the men were employed in this necessary labor, Lewis wrote, others were dressing skins, washing and mending their clothes, etc. Captain Clark and myself killed each a buck immediately on landing. The deer were very gentle and in great numbers. After a detailed description of the trees in the river bottom, he regretted that clouds during the day and night prevented my making any observations. He reported on what had been related to him by scouts who had gone up Corvus Creek to have a look around. Vast herds of buffalo, deer, elk, and antelopes were seen feeding in every direction as far as the eye of the observer could reach. Lewis went to see for himself. Having for many days past confined myself to the boat, he opened his September 17th entry, I determined to devote this day to amuse myself on shore with my gun and view the interior of the country. He set out before sunrise, accompanied by six hunters. They encountered a grove of plums. Lewis described the trees, then wrote, "This forest of plum trees garnish a plain about 20 feet elevated." The whole of the plain, nearly 3 miles by 3 miles, was entirely occupied by the burrows of the barking squirrel, prairie dog. This animal appears here in infinite numbers. The shortness of the grass gave the plain the appearance throughout its whole extent of beautiful bowling grass in fine order. This scenery, already rich, pleasing, and beautiful, was still farther heightened by immense herds of buffalo, deer, elk, and antelopes, which we saw in every direction, feeding on the hills and plains. I do not think I exaggerate when I estimated the number of buffalo which could be comprehended at one view to amount to 3,000. At 8 o'clock a.m., Lewis and his companions rested ourselves about half an hour and regaled ourselves on half a biscuit each and some jerk of elk. Then they set off to kill a pronghorn. Lewis found the pronghorns to be extremely shy and watchful, insomuch that we had been unable to get a shot at them. I had this day an opportunity of witnessing the agility and superior fleetness of this animal, which was to me really astonishing. I pursued a small herd of seven. Bad as the chance to approach them was, I made the best of my way towards them, frequently peeping over the ridge with which I took care to conceal myself from their view. I got within about 200 paces of them when they smelt me and fled. I gained the top of the eminence as soon as possible, from whence I had an extensive view of the country. The antelopes had disappeared in a steep ravine, now appeared at the distance of about 3 miles. Lewis was struck by the rapidity of their flight. It appeared rather the rapid flight of birds than the motion of quadrupeds. I think I can safely venture the assertion that the speed of this animal is equal, if not superior, to that of the finest blooded courser. And with that, the entry suddenly breaks off. There is no ending describing the campfire that night, with the men talking of the strange and wonderful things they had seen. Either Lewis put down his quill, not to take it up again until April 1805, or what he wrote is lost. Over the next week, in the southerly winds of early fall, the expedition sped ahead, making 23, then 25, then 33 miles in one day. The captains finally shot a coyote and added a mule deer to their list. On Sunday, September 23rd, they made 20 miles and camped on the starboard side in a cottonwood grove. As some men set up tents, others gathered firewood, and the cooks got their kettles ready, 3 teenage Teton Sioux swam across. With Driard exchanging messages with them via the sign language, they said there was a band of 80 lodges camped at the mouth of the next river, and a second band of 60 lodges a short distance above the first. The captains gave the boys 2 carats of tobacco and told them to inform their chiefs that the expedition would come up tomorrow for a council. The expedition proceeded in the morning past a 2-mile-long island where Coulter, with the last horse belonging to the expedition, had camped for the night and killed 4 elk. He had hung them on trees along the shore. Lewis sent a pirogue to pick up the meat. As it was being loaded, Coulter ran up the bank to shout that Indians had stolen his horse. Soon after, the captain saw 5 Indians on the bank. They anchored the keelboat and spoke to them, either through signs flashed by Driard or by using the old Frenchman, Pierre Cruzat, who could speak a bit of Sioux, as interpreter. The captains were stern. They said they came as friends, but were ready to fight if need be, and warned that they were not afraid of any Indians. They told a little lie, saying that the stolen horse had been sent by the new father of the Red Children as a present for the chief of the Tetons. They said they would not speak to any Tetons until the horse was returned. The expedition arrived at the mouth of the next river, at the site of present Pierre, South Dakota, late in the afternoon. As a defensive precaution, the party anchored the keelboat off the mouth of the river. The captains put the party on full alert, with one-third ashore on guard, the other two-thirds camping on board the boat and pirogues. In the morning, the captains raised the flagstaff, set up the awning, and prepared for a council, taking the precaution to leave a majority of the party on board, with the keelboat anchored 70 yards offshore so that its swivel gun commanded the site. At 11 o'clock a.m., three chiefs and many warriors came in, bearing large quantities of buffalo meat as a gift. The captains offered some pork. Then it was time to talk. To their dismay, the captains quickly discovered that Crozat could not speak the language beyond some simple words, nor could Driard convey via the sign language the relatively complex thoughts and proposals Lewis was making in his basic Indian speech. Recognizing the difficulty, Lewis cut the speech short and began putting on the traveling medicine show. It started with a close-order drill by uniformed troops marching under the colors of the Republic. Then came the air gun, magnifying glass, and the rest. Finally, Lewis handed out medals and gifts to the chiefs. He designated Black Buffalo as the leading chief present and gave him a medal, a red military coat, and a cocked hat. The other two chiefs, named the Partisan and Buffalo Medicine, got medals. As far as the captains were concerned, they had completed their part. "That's all?" the Tetons demanded, unbelieving. "Some worthless medals and a silly hat?" Sensing the discontent, especially from Black Buffalo's rivals, the Partisan and Buffalo Medicine, the captains invited the chiefs on board the keelboat, where they gave each a quarter glass of whiskey. The chiefs were exceedingly fond of it. They took up an empty bottle, smelted it, and made many simple gestures, and soon began to be troublesome. Clark detailed a party of seven men to help him put the chiefs ashore. The chiefs resisted and had to be forced into the canoe. When it landed, three warriors seized the tow line while another hugged the mast. The Partisan pretended drunkenness and staggered up against us, declaring I should not go on, stating he had not received presents sufficient from us. His insults became personal. He demanded a canoe load of presents before he would allow the expedition to go on. Clark would take no more. He drew his sword and ordered all hands under arms. On the keelboat, Lewis ordered the men to prepare for action. The swivel gun was loaded with 16 musket balls, the blunderbusses were loaded with buckshot, the men threw up the lockers as breastworks, loaded their rifles, and prepared to fire. Up the bank, 20 yards from Clark and the pirogue, some warriors saw Lewis preparing the swivel gun and began to back away, but others strung their bows and took out their arrows from their quivers or began to cock their shotguns. It was a dramatic moment. Had Lewis cried, "Fire!" and touched his lighted taper to the fuse of the swivel gun, the whole history of North America might have changed. Here is one possible scenario. The cannon roared, spitting out 16 musket balls. The blunderbusses roared, spitting out buckshot. The muskets roared, spitting out aimed lead bullets. Sioux warriors were mowed down in the dozens. But there were still hundreds of warriors on the bank, and even as the smoke lifted, they filled the air with arrows and kept them coming, for they could reload and fire at a much faster pace than the American soldiers. Lewis and Clark, prime targets, went down. With the captains incapacitated or dead, Sergeant Ordway rallied the survivors, got into the keelboat, pushed off, and retreated downriver. In short, had that cannon fired, there might have been no Lewis and Clark expedition. The exploration of the Missouri River country and Oregon would have had to be done by others at a later time. Meanwhile, the Sioux would have been implacable enemies of the Americans and in possession of the biggest arsenal on the Great Plains. For some time to come, they would have had the numbers and the weapons to turn back any expedition the United States could send up the Missouri. They would have increased their trade with the British Northwest Company coming out of Canada. In the War of 1812, they would have been British allies, perhaps strong enough to wrest Upper Louisiana away from the Americans and make it part of Canada. Improbable, certainly. Impossible, almost certainly. Still, aside from the possible long-range consequences, the confrontation on the riverbank was threatening to make it impossible for Lewis to carry out his orders with regard to the Sioux, to make a good impression on them and make them into friends of the United States. This was the moment Jefferson had had in mind when he told Lewis in his formal orders to exercise caution. If Lewis recalled that order, he ignored it. He refused to back down and continued to hold the lighted taper over the swivel gun. Nor would Clark decline combat. He kept his sword out of its scabbard. Their blood was up. They were Virginia gentlemen who had been challenged. They were ready to fight. So the white leaders pushed the moment to its crisis. Luckily for them, one of the red leaders stepped forward to avert hostilities. Black Buffalo seized the tow line from the three warriors and motioned to the warrior hugging the mast to go ashore. As they did so, the partisan, sulking, joined his warriors on the bank, 20 yards off. The Indians kept their bows strung. Lewis remained at full alert, ready to fire. Disaster had been avoided, but the crisis continued. Clark turned on the Indians. "I felt myself warm and spoke in very positive terms," he wrote in his journal. He made dire threats. He said he had more medicine on board his boat than would kill 20 such nations in one day. He told Black Buffalo that the expedition must and would go on. He said his men were not squaws but warriors. How much of the threat the Indians understood from Driard's sign language and Crusot's simple words cannot be known, but surely Clark's body language spoke plainly enough. While he was haranguing the Indians, the crew took the pirogue back to the keelboat, where a dozen soldiers jumped in. When the reinforcements got to the bank, some warriors backed off. Then the three chiefs went into conference. Clark awaited the outcome, justifying his actions to himself. "Their treatment to me was very rough," he wrote, "and I think justified roughness on my part." But then he managed to quiet his emotions sufficiently to walk over to the chiefs and offer his hand. The chiefs refused to take it. Clark turned on his heel, ordered his men to join him, and waded out to the pirogue. Before he could set off for the keelboat, Black Buffalo and two warriors waded after him. They indicated that they wanted to sleep aboard the boat. Clark nodded his consent. "We proceeded on about 1 mile," Clark recorded, "and anchored out off a willow island, placed a guard on shore to protect the cooks and a guard in the boat, fastened the pirogues to the boat. I call this island Bad Humored Island, as we were in a bad humor." The first meeting between the Sioux and the Americans had gone badly. Certainly, Lewis and Clark had failed to make the favorable impression on the Sioux that Jefferson had ordered them to do. But short of giving away almost a fifth of their total stock, the contents of one pirogue, there was nothing the captains could do to make that favorable impression. At least no shots had rung out. No arrows had been launched. In the morning, the captain set out early and proceeded some 4 miles. The banks were lined with hundreds of curious but anxious Indians. At Black Buffalo's request, the expedition came to and anchored near his village. The captains invited some men, women, and children to come aboard. Black Buffalo invited Lewis to visit his village. The chief appeared disposed to make up and be friendly, so Lewis consented. The village Lewis visited was a classic nomadic town based on a buffalo and horse economy, numbering about 100 teepees with a population of around 900. These were the Brule band of the Tetons, and they were in high spirits, having only 2 weeks previously won a great battle against the Omahas. The Sioux had killed 75 Omaha warriors and taken 48 women and children prisoners. Crusot, who was with Lewis, could speak Omaha fluently. Lewis told him to find out what he could from the prisoners. Black Buffalo was insistent on showing Lewis the greatest courtesies, including repeated invitations to take a squaw. The Indians made frequent solicitations for Lewis to remain one night longer so that they could show their good disposition towards us. Lewis agreed. In the late afternoon, Clark and the entire party came to the village. Clark saw the Omaha prisoners and judged them a wretched and dejected-looking people. The squaws appear low and coarse, but this is an unfavorable time to judge of them. At dusk, Clark and Lewis were carried with much ceremony on a decorated buffalo robe to the great council lodge in the middle of the village. Fires glowed through translucent teepees as the women prepared a feast. Slabs of buffalo meat roasted over hot coals. Inside the council lodge, 70 elders and prominent warriors sat in a circle. The American sat beside Black Buffalo. In front of them, a 6-foot sacred circle had been cleared for holy pipes, pipe stands, and medicine bundles. After smoking, Black Buffalo spoke with great solemnity. The captains could not make out what he was saying, beyond that the Sioux were poor and the Americans should have pity on them and give them something. Clark answered that the Sioux should make peace with the Omahas, and as a gesture of their goodwill, release the prisoners they held. If Black Buffalo understood the translation of that idea, he must have thought Clark mad. Why should he give up valuable prisoners just to please the white man? And anyway, his people were about to hold a scalp dance, displaying those so recently acquired from the Omahas. It was the first Sioux scalp dance ever seen by Americans. Clark described it. A large fire made in the center, about 10 musicians playing on tambourines made of hoops and skin stretched. Long sticks with deer and goat's hoofs tied so as to make a jingling noise, and many others of a similar kind. Those men began to sing and beat on the tambourine. The women came forward highly decorated in their way, with the scalps and trophies of war of their father, husbands, brothers, or near connection, and proceeded to dance the war dance. Women only dance. Jump up and down. Every now and then, one of the men come out and repeat some exploit in a sort of song, this taken up by the young men, and the women dance to it. The Americans tossed presents of tobacco and beads to the dancers and singers. When one warrior thought he had not received his due, he flew into a rage and broke one drum, threw two others into the fire, then stormed out of the dance line. The drums were retrieved and the dancing went on. Sergeant Ordway found the music delightful and said it was done with great cheerfulness. The dance broke up at midnight. Black Buffalo offered the captain's young women as bed partners. Clark, who understood the meaning of the offering, wrote later that a curious custom with the Sioux is to give handsome squaws to those whom they wish to show some acknowledgments to, but the captains said no. Black Buffalo and the partisan then accompanied the captains to the boat, where they slept for the night. During the night, Cruzat came to the captains to report that the Omahas had told him that the Tetons intended to stop the expedition and rob it. The captains agreed they would show no sign of a knowledge of their intentions, but they slept poorly. It apparently failed to occur to them that the Omaha prisoners had an obvious motive for stirring up the Americans, and might well be lying. In the morning, Clark and Lewis went back to the village. They trod cautiously, suspecting treachery, and therefore are at all times guarded and on our guard. They again offered me a young woman, Clark wrote, and wish me to take her and not despise them. I wavered the subject. That evening there was another scalp dance. It broke up about 11 o'clock p.m., with both captains scarcely able to stay awake. The partisan and one of his warriors accompanied them back to the bank. Clark got into a pirogue to be ferried out to the boat, while Lewis stayed on shore with a guard. Some clumsy steering brought Clark's pirogue slamming broadside into the keelboat's anchor cable. It broke. The boat began to swing dangerously. Clark called out in a loud voice, "All hands up! All hands up and at their oars!" The shouted orders and the hustle and bustle that immediately followed alarmed the partisan. He began hollering that the Omahas were attacking. In 10 minutes, the bank was lined with some 200 warriors, led by Black Buffalo, prepared for anything but believing that the Omahas really were attacking, since they had genuine cause to want to make a surprise raid, and half suspecting that the Americans were in an alliance with their enemies. Misunderstanding cut both ways. Lewis, on shore with a small guard, was convinced that the partisans' shouting was the signal for the intended treachery. He had his men on full alert, rifles primed. Fortunately, the potentially explosive situation quickly resolved itself. When the warriors realized it was a false alarm, they returned to their beds. Lewis returned to the boat, which, because of the lost anchor, had to tie up to a tree under a falling bank, much more exposed than the captains would have liked. Clark concluded his journal entry for the day. All prepared on board for anything which might happen, we kept a strong guard all night in the boat. No sleep. In the morning, after a long, fruitless search for the anchor, the expedition prepared to set out. At that moment, the Tetons appeared on the bank in great number, well armed. Black Buffalo came on board and asked the captains to stay one more day. Simultaneously, several warriors grabbed the bow line. Clark complained to Black Buffalo, who hurried forward to tell Lewis that the warriors only wanted some tobacco and then the expedition might proceed. He wasn't asking for much. A carrot or two of tobacco was all, a trifle merely. But as a symbol, Black Buffalo was demanding what the captains thought of as a high price. It was an acknowledgement of the right of the Sioux to exact a toll from white men using their river. Lewis's patience broke. He said he would not be forced into anything, ordered all hands ready for departure, had the sail hoisted, and detailed a man to untie the bow cable. As the soldier began to untie it, several warriors again grabbed the rope. The partisan demanded a flag and some tobacco as the price of their letting go. Clark threw a carrot of tobacco onto the bank, saying to the chief, "You have told us you are a great man, have influence. Take this tobacco and show us your influence by taking the rope from your men and letting go without coming to hostilities." Clark backed